Coming up on the show today, is a deal to release hostages and pause hostilities between Israel and Hamas close?
I hope there will be good news soon.
Plus, Israel presents its evidence of Hamas's military activity at a Gaza hospital.
They exposed a shaft with a staircase about 10 meters deep that led to a 55-meter underground tunnel ending in a heavy blast door.
And later, the latest from Kyiv and a look ahead to the COP28 Global Climate Conference in Dubai. Today is Tuesday, November 21st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at the Shifa Hospital and healthcare in Gaza coming up in a moment. First, though, this update. Hamas's leader, Ismail Haniyeh, says a truce deal with Israel on hostages is close, while Israel says the parties are making progress. The deal being discussed is expected to swap hostages for Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails, along with a ceasefire to allow for humanitarian aid. The Reuters news agency is reporting that the deal could be announced later on Tuesday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu put the reported deal into the larger context of the war.
We are currently focusing on a very strong and proactive defense in the north in order to achieve a crushing victory in the south. The first goal, the elimination of Hamas, does not stop until it is done. Second goal, the return of the hostages. We are making progress. I don't think it's worth saying too much, not even at this point. I hope there will be good news soon.
As Netanyahu said, Israel is pursuing a very strong defense in the north. The AP's Charles Della Desma has more on that.
The Israeli military has released a video that shows troops battling Palestinian militants in Jabalia, which is a dense urban area in the northern Gaza Strip. The Israeli army's expanded operations across northern Gaza, where residents have been without electricity, water, or access to humanitarian aid for weeks. The front line has shifted to the Jabalia camp near Gaza City that houses refugees from the 1948 war surrounding Israel's creation and their descendants. Israel has been bombarding the area for weeks, and the military say Hamas fighters have regrouped there and in other eastern districts after being pushed out of much of Gaza City. I'm Charles Della Desma.
We've been hearing on this show how many of Israel's attacks in Gaza have been at or near hospitals. Israel says that it has proof Hamas held some Israeli hostages inside the Shifa hospital. Meanwhile, Palestinian officials in Gaza say at least 12 people were killed at the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, where 700 patients and staff were sheltering. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials say they have proof that Hamas used the Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza as a command and control center, a claim that Hamas continues to deny. They exposed a shaft with a staircase about 10 meters deep that led to a 55-meter underground tunnel ending in a heavy blast door. Israel says it has evidence that the U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas used the hospital to hide hostages. The bodies of Israeli hostages Noah Marciano and Yehudit Weiss were found in the hospital complex last week. Hamas said Marciano was killed in an Israeli airstrike, but Israeli pathologists claim that the Israeli soldier was only injured by the airstrike and killed in a separate incident. Daniel Hagari is the Israel Defense Forces spokesman.
According to the intelligence, we have in our hand a concrete intelligence. Hamas terrorists took Noah into Shifa Hospital, where she was murdered quickly.
IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari also showed surveillance footage that showed two hostages, one from Nepal and one from Thailand, inside the hospital. He says the footage was shown to diplomats from these countries.
Hamas taking a hostage inside the vicinity. He doesn't need a treatment, but they're taking it inside the hospital. I will now share this video that shows the same hostage entering into the hospital with a gunman, terrorist, inside the hospital.
Israel says that at least 22 hostages are from Thailand, including a woman believed to have given birth while in captivity. In Shifa Hospital, there were 36 premature babies, and doctors feared for their lives as Israeli troops entered the hospital. Over the weekend, the IDF spokesman says Israel worked with the UN teams and provided incubators to help evacuate the babies into Rafah in southern Gaza and from there to Egypt. The Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health said 5 babies died en route. Israeli officials say they have still not uncovered the entire Hamas tunnel network. While the Israeli army has killed hundreds of Hamas militants, it believes thousands more are still hiding in tunnels deep below Gaza. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The attacks on Gaza hospitals has perhaps been the most controversial part of Israel's reaction to the Hamas offensive. And even as Israeli officials reveal the evidence of Hamas military activity there, the fact remains that hospitals are being destroyed and people need a place to go for health care. Ben Thomas from the Associated Press has that part of the story.
The World Health Organization is warning that health services in Gaza have suffered catastrophic damage. I'm Ben Thomas with the latest.
We are seeing a complete collapse of the higher level infrastructure of the Gazan health system. It is just the most basic of needs that can be met now.
WHO Emergencies Chief Dr. Michael Ryan says the concentration of refugees in crowded camps and other facilities is driving up the risk of epidemics.
There really has been heavy rain. It has flooded a lot of the makeshift camps, and it is generating all kinds of risks. And it's not just the risks of diarrheal disease. The sudden drop in temperature is going to create a problem with pneumonia in children. The stress that those kids are under, the nutritional status that those children have, make it a recipe for epidemics.
Ryan says only 10 of Gaza's 36 hospitals are now functioning in any way at all and will likely be overwhelmed in the coming weeks.
5,500 women are going to give birth in the next month. 15% of them will need a cesarean section. 25% of their children will be born preterm. That is thousands of babies. That's not 31, 29, or 38. That is literally thousands of babies will be born who will be preterm and will need those incubators, will need that kangaroo care, will need their mother with them to be able to provide that. Some of them will need intubation, some will need mechanical ventilation.
I'm Ben Thomas.
As we reported on Monday's program, Iran-backed Houthi rebels from Yemen have captured what they claim is an Israeli cargo ship in the Red Sea. And in a story that honestly would probably be more compelling on TV than on the radio, the Houthis have released video footage of that incident late on Monday. Reuters' Ryan Chang has the story.
Houthi rebels from Yemen were seen storming a cargo ship in the Red Sea in a video released by the Iran-backed group on Monday. Its fighters appeared to land by helicopter onto the top deck. They brandished weapons at the ship's crew and ordered them to lie down. The seized ship, the Galaxy Leader, is now in Yemen's Hodeidah port area, according to its owner, Galaxy Maritime, which is registered in the Isle of Man. The Houthi movement claims the Galaxy Leader has links to Israel. However, Israel has denied this and says the seized ship was British-owned and Japanese-operated. The owner confirmed the ship was illegally boarded on Sunday. Its crew of 25 is made up of nationals from Bulgaria, Ukraine, the Philippines, and other countries. All communications have since been cut with the vessel. The Houthis are a group aligned with Iran that have emerged as a major military force in the Arabian Peninsula. Last week, the leaders said they would target Israeli ships in the Red Sea and said attacks would continue until, quote, Israeli aggression, referring to the war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip, is stopped. A representative from Hamas thanked the Houthis for seizing the ship. He called it a welcome step in support of the Palestinian people. The United States on Monday denounced the seizure. It said it was a breach of international law and demanded the Houthis immediately release the vessel and its crew.
That's Reuters' Ryan Chang reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The UN Secretary General has some grave news about the climate ahead of the COP28 conference, We'll hear about that shortly. Now to Ukraine. It's where we find U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. He traveled there on Monday to reassure Ukrainian leaders that the United States will continue to support the country in its fight against Russia. It was Austin's first visit to the Ukrainian capital since April of 2022, and the first time members of the press have accompanied him there since the war began. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the secretary and has this report from Kyiv.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Monday and his cabinet to discuss the immediate winter fight and long-term security planning for Ukraine. The surprise stop comes amid concern that U.S. support for Ukraine could be wavering as U.S. attention shifts to the conflict in the Middle East. Zelensky told Austin that his coming to Ukraine was an important signal for Ukrainians at this difficult time.
But we're thankful to American people. They have with us all these difficulties.
Austin praised Zelensky's leadership during the nearly two-year war, which began in February 2022 when Russia illegally invaded Ukraine.
That you've led the Ukrainian people to do things that were unimaginable to most people from the very beginning. And so we've seen great ingenuity, we've seen courage on part of the Ukrainian people that has really impressed the world. The message I bring you today, Mr. President, is that the United States of America is with you. You will remain with you for the long haul.
After the meeting, Austin announced another aid package for Ukraine to include more munitions and an additional HIMARS artillery rocket system. He also met with Ukrainian troops who had fought on the front lines near Bakhmut. VOA asked Defense Secretary Austin here at St. Michael's Square about concerns that Russia will try to use this winter to dig in their defenses in territory they control.
You heard President Zelensky say a number of times that he intends to continue to keep the pressure on the Russians. And so we expect that, that will absolutely happen.
Senior U.S. defense officials say air defenses will be critical, adding that the United States has surged air defense systems and munitions to Ukraine. The temperature has really started dropping these days, and Western officials and Ukrainian officials are concerned that Russia may try to use the same playbook this winter as it did last winter, targeting critical infrastructure and cutting supply in some of the coldest days of the year. Drone attacks over the weekend caused power outages in hundreds of towns. Some of the drones also targeted here in Kyiv, but Ukrainian officials say all the drones launched at the capital were shot down. Reporting in Kyiv, I'm Carla Babb, VOA News.
Staying with the crisis in Ukraine for another moment, November 21st marks the 10-year anniversary of the Maidan Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine, an event that some say helped set the stage for Putin's interest in and ultimate invasion of Ukraine. All this as Russia continues the drone and missile attacks on Ukrainian cities. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
On Tuesday, Ukraine marks 10 years since the beginning of the Revolution of Dignity, a nationwide protest that started in Maidan, which is Kyiv's central square, when then-President Viktor Yanukovych refused to sign the association agreement with the EU and denounced Ukraine's new path towards Russia. The demonstrators demanded the fulfillment of the government's earlier promises of closer ties with the West, with deeper economic and political cooperation, and the signing of the EU association agreement. The protests in Kyiv resulted in clashes between protesters and special riot police, causing the death of 108 protesters and the wounding of many others. Following the Ukrainian Revolution on March 4, 2014, former President Yanukovych put into writing his request to Russian President Putin to send military forces to Ukraine. On the same day, Putin requested and received authorization from the Russian parliament to deploy troops to Ukraine in response to the protests. Russian troops accordingly mobilized throughout Crimea and the southeast of Ukraine. By March 2, Russian troops had complete control over Crimea. Ukraine considers these events as the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war that continues now with a Russian full-scale invasion in place. To mark the occasion, the President of Moldova, Maia Sandu, made in an announced visit to Ukraine. Together with President Zelensky and First Lady Olena Zelenska, she honored the memory of activists who died during the Revolution of Dignity. Also, the President of the European Council, Charles Michel, came to Kyiv for the occasion. His visit takes place right before the upcoming European Council summit in mid-December, where EU leaders will discuss the European Commission's recommendation to start formal accession negotiations with Ukraine. In his address to the nation, President Zelensky said that Ukraine has come a great part of the way to the EU and will do whatever it takes to see the Ukrainian star shine on the EU flag. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue the shelling of the Ukrainian cities. Ukrainian air forces reported overnight Russian attacks involving 10 Shahed drones and one Iskander-K cruise missile. Central, western, and northern regions were targeted. Ukrainian air defense confirmed the destruction of 9 drones and a missile. No casualties or damage has been reported. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Switching now to the climate crisis, a new United Nations analysis paints an unpleasant picture for the future. Reuters' Ilan Rubens has more.
Present trends are racing our planet down a dead-end 3-degree temperature rise.
The world is on track to warm by nearly 3 degrees Celsius this century. That's according to a new United Nations analysis released ahead of the COP28 climate summit in the United Arab Emirates. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The report shows that the emissions gap is more like an emissions canyon.
The annual Emissions Gap Report assesses countries' promises to tackle climate change compared with what is needed. Anne Olhoff is the chief scientific editor of this report.
Based on what countries are doing right now, if they continue the current efforts of climate mitigation, then we're looking at limiting temperature increase to 3 degrees throughout this century. With the climate promises for 2030, we're looking at an increase of between 2.5 and 2.9 degrees Celsius. So that's massive global warming and a lot way beyond the Paris Agreement goal.
At 3 degrees Celsius of warming, scientists predict the world could pass several catastrophic points of no return, from the runaway melting of ice sheets to the Amazon rainforest dying out.
We will see maybe 10 times as many extreme weather events in terms of extreme temperatures. We will see more heavy precipitation. And of course, there are lots of damages following, such as wildfires and so forth.
World leaders will soon meet in Dubai for the COP28 summit, with the aim of keeping the Paris Agreement warming target of 1.5 degrees Celsius alive. But the new UN report does little to inspire hope that this goal remains in reach. It found that greenhouse gas emissions must fall by 42% by 2030 to hold warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius. But global emissions actually rose by more than 1% between 2021 and 2022. Reaching a record 57.4 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent.
We must reverse course. And as we have seen in this report, the crucial aspect is the addiction to fossil fuels. So it's time to establish a clear phase down with a time limit linked to the 1.5 degrees, and it's time to be determined in pursuing that phase-down policy. And I hope that governments will understand it, and I hope that there will be a clear signal from this COP that we must move in that direction.
That's Reuters' Ilan Rubens reporting for us. And as we heard in Ilan's report, COP, the annual global climate conference, is coming up soon. For a preview, VOA's Laurie London speaks with Nathan Cogswell, research associate with the World Resource Institute.
I think first, COP28, the upcoming conference in Dubai, offers a historic opportunity to course correct and to demonstrate commitment to addressing climate change. The reason I mentioned historic opportunity is that this COP will be the first what we call global stocktake, a process underneath the Paris Agreement to assess collective progress towards the agreement's goals and to chart a path forward to deliver sort of that that rapid response to the crisis. And so this year at the COP is the first opportunity, is the first global stocktake, and really provides that opportunity. There are a couple of different areas where there are significant opportunities in particular, one being on resilience and addressing the climate impacts and preparing communities and supporting communities in responding to those impacts. Another is on fossil fuels and the energy transition and rapidly shifting away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, to energy efficiency and fossil-free transport. And then the third area, I would say, is on food and transforming food and land use systems and the ways in which countries think about protecting forests and ecosystems.
When you mention these three things, are you talking about actual commitments or plans of action? How does that look?
So to take the example first on resilience, on adaptation and loss and damage, last year at COP27, countries agreed to establish funding arrangements, including a fund for addressing what we call loss and damage. And these are the impacts from climate change that cannot be adapted to. And so the task this year for countries at the conference is to agree on how to operationalize that fund, how to ensure that finance is new, additional, and flows to those local communities who need it. So that's one example on resilience. On fossil fuels, there has been a lot of discussion recently in the UN climate process, but also the broader climate policy debate about expanding renewables. And so at the conference this year, we could see countries agree to tripling renewable energy, to doubling energy efficiency, to rapidly shifting away from fossil fuels and decreasing investments, public support, and subsidies for fossil fuels. And on the food example, the COP28 presidency led by the UAE is planning to release a bold declaration, which is meant to outline a commitment to incorporate food into climate plans, to identify ways to transform the food systems, and deliver finance and support for countries and communities and people to do so.
And is there any kind of accountability with all of these commitments? How does that work as far as actually following through?
Great question. And some of these commitments carry great weight. Those are things that countries all agree through the formal legal negotiation process that they would agree to. And so particularly there, we're expecting negotiated outcomes on loss and damage and on the questions around energy. And on the example on food, the declaration that's being led by the UAE, it's important that we continue to follow up, that leaders, you know, begin to think about how to set out action plans, how to deliver on that commitment, and that there's effort given to return to that in future years and ensure transparency of progress and ensure accountability in meeting those targets.
And do you think that anything has changed with all these extreme weather events and, of course, extreme heat? Do you think there is a growing sense of urgency, seriousness for following through now?
I think the sense of urgency grows each day, each year. There's been an urgent need for action for many years since the establishment of the UN climate process. And I think that continues to grow each and every year. The UN climate process is there to support governments and to support international cooperation among them. But ultimately, we are relying on governments and leaders and communities and businesses to take the steps necessary to make the investments that are needed to address climate change.
That's Lori London, host of VOA's Issues in the News, speaking with Nathan Cogswell of the World Resource Institute. And that's going to wrap up today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.